Hello and welcome to this discussing episode on the Beyond podcast. We're deep into rehearsals and prep for our pop-up Festival of Henrician Drama, Entertaining Henry, which this episode is part of the build-up to. But because of this season, I haven't had a vast amount of time to do a tidier edit of this discussion with Professor Liz Oakley-Brown. It was recorded live, it's fine, but normally I would clean up some of the hesitations, deviations, and repetitions, and any minor errors that occur. Suffolk, for example, is referred to as, I think, Sussex at one point. But apart from that, it was, for us, a fun little chat, and hopefully you will find it so. So, warts and all, I pass you over to your host, past Robert Crichton, in discussion with Professor Liz Oakley-Brown. Live. Enjoy. Hello and welcome to this discussing live episode. I'm recording this with a live studio audience via Zoom as part of the run-up to our season of Henrician drama, Entertaining Henry, running at the Key Theatre Sudbury for three nights in June. Six plays, 3 days, one king from the 20th to the 22nd of June, 2025, for anyone listening to this in the future. Just make sure you check what year it is. Today we are talking snails, fighting snails from the Tudor world and beyond. As next week we are staging the play Thersites, which features a figure from mythology fighting a snail, because... Well, the reason for that is more complicated than you'll think. We'll come to that in this discussion with my wonderful guest. Who are you and what is your purpose in life?
Hello, my purpose in life this evening is just to talk snails. That's it. Pure and simple, Rob. Pure and simple. And you can imagine, I am a professional early modern literary person, and the opportunities to talk snail are not that common. So Thersites is one of my go-to texts. For the snail, really. So that is my purpose in life.
Excellent.
Yes. And this evening.
Yes. Other interests do engage us. And we were saying before we were coming on that we are reasonably good in this general area of theatre and some have some specialities, but we're not the absolute snail experts or the absolute experts on some of the details here, but we're hopefully going to have a lot of fun and you're going to have fun coming along with us. So my opening question is, what is it with snails and why is everyone fighting them?
Well, it's interesting. People aren't always fighting snails, you know, actually. There is a brilliant, and I just said to Rob before we started, I wanted to give a shout out to some people who do know their stuff about snails quite a bit more than I do. And if you follow me on Blue Sky, I posted something yesterday, which was the link to the BBC Radio 4 programme that Alex Bovey recorded in 2020 in the heart of the pandemic and lockdown, called... Fighting Snails, and it wasn't just about snails, it was about all those brilliantly weird marginalia. And so the snails, I suppose, in the 16th century come from a quite a long tradition of weird marginalia. That's where I'm going to stop there, because I could go on forever, but weird marginalia. And one of the strands of the snails, they did all kinds of things. You didn't just have knights fighting snails, you had rabbits catching them. I've got a mug behind me with some of the brilliant medieval illuminations, but I won't reach back and get it. But you've got snails partaking in all kinds of activities with all various kind of human and non-human folk. Yeah, actually, yeah. So, but in terms of the snail, I suppose people don't really know what the snails stood for, I guess, because the brilliant poet, 1920s poet Marianne Moore, had a poem about the snail, which uses this brilliant word about its contractility. That's her word, contractility. And I guess the fact that the snail can sort of move its horns in and out in ways that humans can't kind of means that its movement, you know, it can hide, can't it? It can hide in ways that humans, I don't think, can. Correct me if I'm wrong. Anybody in the audience? I don't think humans can hide.
I'm going to be having a go next week. But
Well, yeah. So so I kind of think then it lends itself to a strand of interpretation that considers a snail to be representative of cowardice, maybe. But I think in this play, it's a version of that. But I'm not so sure. You know, I think in this play, it stands for all kinds of things, actually. But I guess the element with the fighting snails and the marginalia is because of that contractility. You know, they can hide and they can come out again. In the movement is so different than human movement. And I think that's one of the reasons I love them. But also, I guess if you're scrutinising them and trying to utilise them in terms of the relationships to humans, they do other things.
Yeah, so that's the sort of the precedence that we have in place. This is a play from, putatively 1537. We have a very specific window for this play, Thersites, in terms of the version that we are looking at. There's a wider sort of textual history to this play, but we will come to the end of the play, which gives us why we think this happened with potentially within a 12-day radius. I mean, that doesn't mean the play only ever got performed during that period. But it's midway towards the end of Henry VIII's reign. And we have this sort of whole world of Henrician drama going on. Interludes of various different lengths, performed in various different contexts. Often at big gatherings, banquets are one of the kind of settings that you might have. But you also might have performances for institutions like Inns of Court or various educational institutions as well. And may be performed by students. In fact, that's one of the potential performers for this play, Thersites. So that's sort of the world of drama. It's before establishing theatre spaces where you have to get access to a very specific space where there is some sort of barrier of cost. This is theatre that's sort of happening where people want it to happen and in different contexts. And that's sort of the universe of Tudor drama that we're exploring as part of this season, and one of the reasons why we're doing Thersites is also it's a damn silly play. I mean, shall we attempt to explain the plot?
I rewatched 2021's the kind of, let's call it, staged recording that you did for the Medieval Theatre Conference that Claire Egan ran at Lancaster, and I had forgotten, if I'd ever realised, because it is very funny. I found it funny this afternoon. I may not find it funny when I see Rob perform it, but, you know, it can depends on the mood you're in, doesn't it? There's a lot of silliness in it. And what I hadn't realised is that it brings the audience in a lot. So there's quite a lot. So we begin. So I'm going to go for the plot now. You can see that I'm doing a little preamble. We begin with this figure called Thersites. And I think it's really important. And I've forgotten the name of the actor who plays Thersites in your production.
Alexandra Kataghida.
Who is amazing. And it's important, I think, to have the complete, the kind of stance and the attitude of what is a figure called Thersites, who, if you know your classical literature, you will have a sense of Thersites. But it, I guess one of the laughs, one of the jokes could be that this Thersites is nothing like the Thersites that you may have heard of. Mm. So I'm going to pause because I'm going to turn to Robert now and say, and Thersites in classical literature.
Oh, you're passing the classical literature over to me.
We're doing the dance. I start the dance.
Yeah, this is the dance. So if the play presents him as more of a braggart soldier of this person who is this try-hard, wannabe fighting man, whereas the sort of... And there's an element of that in the mythological version of him, that he's someone who was at Troy and is there, but he's much more... Just generally abusing everybody on some level. And there is an element of question about his physicality as well, which I don't necessarily think is something that this play is addressing or is interested in. But he's supposed to have some form of physical disability, and that may be connected to the nature of his character, which is a whole entirely separate area that we're not really going to be talking about today, but would actually make a very good discussion for another area. But in someone who's in theory, you know, quite obscene, and just generally a downer on the whole war at Troy, in various different forms.
Yeah, he's definitely not a heroic character. So it's not as if this interlude is starting, is kind of reversing, is presenting Thersites, who perhaps was a heroic character, and doing something else. It's not that at all. It's something far more subtle, which I think I've grasped. It's I think, appealing to its audience's knowledge, I think, in some respects, and sort of accepting that Thersites that they would know isn't actually a positive character, and almost giving us a bit of backstory to Thersites, perhaps, because it's interesting because we know he's come back from a war, but oh my goodness, we cannot escape. And this is where we have to bring the second really important character into the apart from the snail, of course, but the snail was exceptional.
We will come to the snail. But
the human, the other important human character is Mater, I think. I mean, you know, and it seemed to me that if this play was produced around the time that Edward was born, it is a play about sons and mothers in some respects. And in fact, the first like 20 minutes, really, depending on how long you dramatise it for, is, you know, firstly, a long bit where you're introduced to Thersites, this braggart.
Who wants to buy some armour.
That's right. He buys some armour. We'll come back. There's some more wordplay. So there's another important figure, which it depends, doesn't it, on your perspective. But I like to think Mater's quite important because his reactions to Mater, you know, he's a bully, you know, but she also tries to stop him going off to war. So there's a really interesting relationship there that I don't think I'd like to delve too deeply into.
Yeah, so we have Thersites, we have his mother, and there's this question of, does Thersites actually want to go to war, or is he just posing?
Yeah.
To go to war, and actually he doesn't want to go at all. And the very opening of the play is he's buying armor from Malsaber,
right.
From Vulcan's forge, and he's trying to buy the best armor in the universe, and it's a constant sort of back and forth between you know, the purchase he wants to make and the salesmanship of Malsaber saying, no, this is the best armor in the universe, mate. Yeah, absolutely. I didn't take it from the back of the shop at all.
And again, a lot of humor, again, on the production and what you know, how you're trying to produce it, I guess. A lot of humor, I think, could come from that interaction of the whole armor business, which is why he's going to just, I think, between Thersites and his mother, you have got this quite a long bit of business then with Malsaber, also known as Vulcan, I suppose. Again, this play domesticates, you know, in interesting ways, I think. Kind of it transposes these classical tropes, ideas, concepts that a learned audience will recognise, but can get enjoyment out of. And I think that enjoyment might be lost on people like me, but... for example, I did find this afternoon to the extent that Malsaber, the person who's making the armour, is adept at what he's doing, is questionable. You can make a lot of humour out of that. There's quite an extended bit of wordplay, which I did find funny this afternoon, about the kind of slippage between salad, you know, leaves, edibles, and salad, helmet. And when you read it on the page, you think, oh, for goodness sake. But actually, in performance, it can be very amusing,
and certainly that's the plan. The only disadvantage for a modern audience is you have to explain to the audience in advance what a salad is.
And
in fact, there is an introduction which I've lifted from our version from 4 years ago, which to say was a Zoom version which you can watch on YouTube. There'll be links in the show description for that. But yeah, so we have this relationship between Thersites and his armourer. The armourer is dispensed with relatively swiftly, and then we get into his relationship with his mother, and also in the background a professional soldier, an actual pucker soldier, who's going, who is this guy?
He's just come back from Calais, isn't he? So he's been out doing, you know, quite an immediate battle, I guess. You know, this is what I mean about this play doing interesting things with time and history and space, that I guess that is a battle, you know, that people would recognise. Oh, yeah, Major Timmy is Brian's mother from Life of Brian. Yeah, yeah, Greg, that is a good observation. Just back to do something.
Thank you from the chat there.
It's true. But yeah, so I think this kind of idea of maybe, you know, weaponry, armoury, war, like an older kind of war and a newer war, you know, that is very serious. That could be that is a very serious strand, I think.
And so within this this matrix now of having met the character, having met his mother, having a professional soldier in the background watching this guy, we are introduced to a snail.
Yeah.
That's the point when the snail appears. This is the point where everyone now is starting to really hone in on where we're going with this. We should really note that I think at this point that this is a play that's been adapted from an earlier text by a chap called Textor, of whom we don't know a vast amount. He was writing dialogue plays and texts for his students over in Paris in the previous generation. He's dead by this point or very late in his career at this point. And he has a reasonable vogue of in translation as part of this sort of humanist scholarship that's going on at the time. But his snail is a bit different in the original.
Yes, well, his snail is not a snail, actually. The word used is testudo, which for those of you who know your Latin is tortoise. Okay, so again, you might think, that's different. And I'm going to just look at my notes here because I'm going to get this wrong. Testudo is a term used to describe how Roman soldiers overlap their shields, right, to form protection. So in some respects, makes a lot more sense to have Thersites sort of thinking he sees a tortoise, a testudo, coming toward him. But for some reason, and again, who knows why, but again, it might be the timely humour of the Tudor snail. We have a snail. Mm. and I love thinking about this now and in performance. And how on earth did they, you know, how was it originally performed? Mm. And again, those of you that know about Tudor performance practices could kind of think about that. But I just love the conceit of having this snail come into view, which I thought... not dismissing tortoises at all, but I just find the snail far more interesting.
Well, they have a similar mechanic in the sense that they are a shell with something that's that can be retracted. So within the logic of the play, it does the same thing.
It does.
But the thing about the snail is it is so much smaller. You know, it's this tiny little thing. And this is the big question in performance that we've played with before and we're playing with in a slightly different way again, is... Well, how big does the snail need to be for it to read for an audience? So presumably you're producing some kind of a puppet, because the snail has stage directions. The snail, at a specific point, retracts its horns in, and it's an important cue in the text. And when we did it on Zoom, a Leaky Chapel built a wonderful snail shell and used a hand to do the actual horns. Our upcoming version is going to be a bit different. There will be a number of snails. There were originally going to be three snails in different scales. There are probably only going to be two at our current state, but we shall see. There's still a week and a half to go of snail construction options. But we have a certain design aesthetic that we're going for, so we'll see what happens. But yeah, the question of how do you do the snail is a really interesting one, because the snail, to a large degree, doesn't have to do a lot, so it doesn't have to be very complicated. But the comic potential of said snail is pretty big.
It's vast, I think. And when I was thinking about this play and just writing about it from a non-human perspective, you know, I this is my first time I've really ever thought about the humans in this to some extent. But I'm very interested. There's also a worm. We might come onto that, but we'll just stay with the snail for the moment. I mean, I was thinking, I don't think there's a stage direction that tells us that the snail leaves. So I
no.
I love the idea.
I will check this. I'm going to live textual criticism as we go.
Yeah, I love the idea of the snail just kind of. I don't know. Does the snail stand there, just being there anyway, just being there, looking? Now I don't know if a snail can do this. This kind of asks a lot of the snail and the performer, of looking. I don't know, intimidating, but in a kind of snail-like way. Now, I don't know what the heck I'm talking about. It's been a long day. But that idea of if you had the snail, there's, because there's some more business that goes on after after Thersites thinks that he has defeated the snail. And, of course,
The snail is the halfway point. I mean, the snail stage directions are, here must a snail appear unto him, and he must look fearfully upon the snail. Then we have, then he must fight against the snail with his club, and he casts his club away. Here he must fight then with his sword against the snail, and the snail draweth her horns.
Yes.
In. So the snail is gendered.
It is, and you know, it's so interesting. Well, I find it interesting that it wasn't until the 17th century that the hermaphroditic nature of snails was actually recorded. And if I was a really good scholar, I'd tell you, but you can read my chapter. There we are, this plug. So it is really interesting that the snail is a her, which again, given, and what we should probably say, well, we didn't, is that Thersites, before we get to the other figures on the stage, the Mulcibe and then the mother, there is some really bawdy stuff going on. With him and some of the younger women in the audience. So there is a whole strand of misogyny, you know, so I don't think it's a coincidence that this snail is gendered female, actually, because to me it makes a lot of sense if you then sort of read the play from a feminist or a gender's perspective, that you've really got then, you know, Thersites trying to defeat a coded woman, coded snail, which is impossible. Now we know, but
yeah, I mean, yeah, this is the thing. I'm not sure how you're going to tell the audience that the.
No, well, you know, I'm just kind of taking the opportunity now. But that, but you could. Well, I don't know. Again, you don't want to, and I'm being serious here. How you? I mean, that when you read it, you know, given depending on how you're reading it, it makes quite a lot of difference, doesn't it? But I suppose. In the 21st century, we now know that snails are not gendered. So what are you going to do, Rob?
Well, everyone's going to have
too much of a surprise.
Yeah, going to have to come and find out. though I think it would be fair to say the snail will have a beard. So in this particular interpretation, unless someone decides to step up and be the snail instead,
Oh, no casting clue there.
So we have this fight with the snail, and the snail withdraws from combat. I mean, it'd be fair to say I don't think Thersites technically wins.
I think
by any stretch of the imagination.
Yes.
But at which point the soldier steps forward and goes, who is this guy, and challenges Thersites to a fight, and Thersites runs away and hides under his mother's skirts and escapes from the knight. And that's effectively where there is now a change from the original the source material, the large chunk that the author, and we don't know who the author precisely is. It has been attributed to Nicholas Udall. Udall wrote one confirmed play, Ralph Royster Doister, and then has been attributed for author of Respublica, Thersites, Jack Juggler, and Jacob and Esau, of which you can say yay or nay, depending on taste. I think they're. It's reasonable to say that those plays all fit within that sort of mode of writing, but there is no real definitive answer on that. And frankly, that's as far as attribution I can be bothered to do, because I'm not a big person for saying who the author is really matters, because a lot of these are very generic plays. So the author, whoever they are, has inserted now a sequence, which I think has a certain political context. from Henry's, that point in Henry's reign, because a little lad, Telemachus, as the play insists you pronounce his name, Telemachus, turns up with a letter saying that he has an ailment. Would you care to describe his predicament?
Yes, he has worms is what he has. And this is where Mater comes back into play. It would be beneficial if Telemachus could be cured, let's put it that way.
Yes.
For all. And there's a very, very, very long, incantation, spell, goodness knows what we're going to call it. Weirdness. Where the stage directions, again, you've got your text there. Telemachus lies down or something.
Yes.
I've got that. And then Mater performs some sort of conjuration spell, who knows what, but it's very long.
And then he must lay him down with his belly upward, and she must bless him from above to beneath, from top to toe, beneath as low down as you need to for worms, I assume, and then says the following, which is a fascinating bit of text to try and pick apart. Blast of the bottle that bloweth Aeolus wind, the buttock of the butter bought at Buckingham, the body of the beer that with Bevis came, the Baxter of Ballockbury with her baking pell, etc. I'm just sight reading that.
It's very long.
It's incredibly long with all these bouncing sounds and alliteration and wordplay, which I'm assuming is some sort of satire on Catholic Mass within the context of Henry VIII's reign at this point.
I think that's probably the most logical explanation for this very weird moment in the context. I mean, actually, it makes more sense if you extrapolate it from the rest of the play in the way that you've just done, Robert, and just then sort of explain it. But once you've had this fight with a snail, and it's quite quick, isn't it? I suppose the interludes, as we know, are not long. So you as a member of the audience, you've just got over the snail fight, and then you have a little bit of business, and then it's this worming business, and it's like, okay. So again, from a 21st century perspective, watching it in performance, it is odd, I think, but not bad odd, but just kind of curious odd, But I think, as you've just described it, that makes perfect sense. How that fits then with the first bit is kind of interesting. Or does it not?
Well, yeah, I mean, there is no stage direction for any worms being extracted. I mean, when we did our Zoom version, we did have a worm. It was a very jolly worm. It was very happy. And full disclosure, this is a sequence that we're not doing in our live staging this time around. As ever, we are always playing around with what we think is going to work for a modern audience. And we've already mentioned, for example, some of the misogyny earlier. We have trimmed that out. I mean, there's still always going to be some elements in there. But there is a matter of trying to tighten up the something that doesn't have a plot. I mean, we said at the beginning, let's explain the plot. There isn't really a plot. Thersites is a braggart, and he's going to get his just desserts in a few minutes.
And we're going to have some, I suppose, a couple of non-human organisms, I'm trying to living creatures, the snail and the worm, that obviously are quite timely for various reasons. The snail, as we've discussed, we're not quite sure, but snails were popular in terms of allegorical interpretations. And I guess worms were very common. What can I say?
Yeah, I mean, if you're living quite close to a lot of livestock in various fashions, I don't know precisely how these things work, but make sure you cook your pottage thoroughly. And then we return to Textor's original narrative, where basically the Miles, the soldier, returns and Thersites downs tools and runs away, and the soldier is left alone to speak to the audience. And this is why we know that, or at least this bit of the text that I'm going to read now, has a 12-day window for performance. So at the end of a play, it's usually turned to the audience. I'll explain the moral. They explain the moral. And then it's prayers for the king or queen. And so pray for his grace with hearts that doth not feign, that long he may rule us without grief or pain. Beseech ye also that God may save his queen, lovely Lady Jane, and the prince that hath sent them between to augment their joy and the commons' felicity. Fare ye well, sweet audience. God grant you all prosperity. So that is from Friday the 12th of to Wednesday the 24th of October, when the elements mentioned there are true. Because it's all rather sad, because, of course, that's from the birth of Edward to the death of his mother. Which sort of is a bit of a downer to take what is otherwise a very fun and silly play, various issues with it aside. But this gives us a potential snapshot of when they were thinking of performing it. Mm. And maybe it wasn't performed at this time because everything went horribly wrong. And actually, this is something that was never said outside of a rehearsal.
Mm. Exactly, because it's not, you know, it's quite, as you know, an interlude, I keep saying, is short. So it goes through quite a lot, even though nothing happens. It does go through a lot of emotions, it does actually. And, you know, from our perspective, then it goes from this sort of ridiculous play to this very sad kind of reminder. And I said earlier that I'm sort of subsequently seeing this play is more and more about sons and mothers, actually, in or the mother figure. And then, of course, we have a mother figure who dies, which doesn't really fit with the play at all.
Mm. And especially, you know, when we also, just occurring to me that this whole moment of cunning folk, sympathetic magic that is occurring there is in terribly poor taste at that precise moment in time. So you can almost see people going, we're not doing this one. This is no longer appropriate. And at some point ends up on the print market because it's lying around.
Yeah, and it wasn't printed, was it, till the 60s? Have I got that right?
Yes, it's not printed for a while. So it's as with so many plays at this period, is that it's not like later in, you know, the end of the century when printing sort of figures out what to do with the theatre industry, and plays will sort of get printed within a couple of years of appearing on stage. Everything's much more ad hoc. And certainly when Elizabeth, I think, comes to the throne, there's an awful lot of people pulling out the stuff that they didn't think was going to get printed. And a lot of stuff just sort of comes out of the woodwork, actually. And, you know, the potentially mocking the Catholic Mass is something that you wouldn't have got printed under Mary, for example.
No, and I think I'm going to show a book, and I'm going to try it, because this is the one, in case you don't know, that this is Marie Anderson's brilliant edition, which has got everything that I know about this play is from there. And I think she tells us that nothing is much known about the printer either of this play. So it's kind of quite frustrating if you want to do the kind of wider contextual interpretations that we enjoy doing, to think about what other plays was this printer printing. We don't have that either, really. So it's a curiosity, I think. Mm. As I say, I came to it because of the snail. I don't think I've ever come to it otherwise, to be honest. How did you come to it?
Because we do everything.
There you are.
I mean, my personal journey is the same. I also have a copy of three Tudor classical interludes, which I think is probably the most available version now is out there. I don't know whether it appears in any, off the top of my head, any other. I could have a quick look. I could grab Wiggins and have a little look. But certainly that's the most textually authoritative version that you'll find, and it is very good. Now, a thing I hadn't told you I was going to ask, and I don't know if you know the answer to this. I don't know the answer to this, but this is something that has been bouncing around. So the name Thersites is a genus of snail.
Yes, do you know?
But those kind of classifications happen later. And so Did they name the snails after this play?
I do know about the genus of snail. Mm. I do know that the classifications probably weren't until the 19th century. Mm. Who the heck knows? It's so fascinating.
Answers on the postcard, people out there, please let us know, because I say this kind of classification starts very generally in the 17th century, picks up a gear in the 18th, and really gets going in the 19th century. It seems really weird. Are we missing a meaning of Thersites that we don't know about that they're grabbing?
Maybe somebody on the call knows. And if I, you know, maybe this is what I'm going to spend the rest of my, you know, who knows what's going to happen to academia. Maybe that's what I'll do for the rest of my being, is because that it is a fascinating link. And I think I am right. I think that that particular genus of snail was that 19th century. So it is quite modern, I think. Again, correct me if I'm wrong, but when I found that trace, again, my question is the same as yours. And it sort of led there for a bit. But maybe, you know, maybe the next time we meet up, Rob, and, you know, if I get down to Sussex, then we'll have an answer, because there might be, there's got to be something. There's got to be, of course. Or maybe it's just one of those curious, serendipitous things. But you're right, yeah.
Can it just be a coincidence? Well, we're going to find out a bit more about this play in live performance in a little over a week's time. The version that we put on Zoom is on YouTube, and there'll be links in the show description. And there will probably be a full cast audio adaptation with this, where I will write dialogue for the snail or something like that. That will, I'm sure, appear sometime in the future. As ever, we keep returning to these plays again and again, just to see what different things can come out of it, and we appeal to you in the world to think kindly on the snail and make more of the snail yourselves and let us know about it. Do you have any final thoughts to throw in before we close and say hello to the audience?
I don't actually. I think again, it's just a real privilege and to talk about a text like this, because where else would I? Except in my book. No, where else would I? But thank you, Rob. I've really enjoyed it. And yeah, thank you so much. I hope it's vaguely entertaining. We've clearly had a nice time.
We had a lovely time. This is the point where the audience start throwing things at us digitally. So we will be performing this at the Key Theatre in Sudbury on the 22nd, Sunday the 22nd of June 2025. There are two other days of shows. This will be part of a double bill with The Pardoner and the Friar, another very anarchic bit of Tudor theatre. Will we return for more live discussions like this in the future? I don't know. We definitely have a lot of discussion episodes coming out in the podcast over the next few months. Some of them recorded nearly a year ago. I'm so sorry, Laurie. I am so sorry. I will put it out eventually. But all that remains is to thank my wonderful guest, Professor Liz Oakley-Brown, for joining me today. Thank you very much, and goodbye.
Goodbye.